Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Diaz, editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. We also invite our listening audience and welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Readers of the San Francisco Chronicle are well aware of Joel Brinkley's clear-eyed analysis of the world. His weekly column in the Sunday Insights section carries the depth and the authority of a journalist who has reported from 46 states in more than 50 nations over the past three decades. Joel is a graduate of the University of North Carolina. He began his journalism career with the Associated Press Wire Service. He went on to report at the Richmond News Leader and Louisville Courier Journal before joining the New York Times in 1983. He spent 23 years at the Times as a reporter and editor, among his many roles, chief of the Times Jerusalem Bureau. Joel earned a Pulitzer Prize in International Reporting in 1980 and was twice a finalist for a Pulitzer in Investigative Reporting. He is author of five books. Joel joined Stanford University's Department of Communication as a Hearst Visiting Professional in Residence in fall 2006. His column, did I mention it's available in the Chronicle? Insights section, every Sunday, also appears in 50 newspapers and websites in the United States and abroad. We certainly picked a convenient week to have him here to speak about Israel and the Arab Spring. Please join me in welcoming to the Commonwealth Club, Joel Brinkley.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. And I was here just a few months ago, and happy to be back. I've actually been doing a lot of speaking recently, and as I stand here, I think about the first time I ever gave a speech, a stand-up speech. It was quite a number of years ago, and it was at a little state college in Big Rapids, Michigan, and I had to change planes three times to get there. Well, once on stage, I was flattered to see that the auditorium was full, elbow to elbow, all the way to the back row. And I later learned that attendance was mandatory. And after I'd returned home, I learned that a professor teaching a speech writing class had ordered his students to critique my speech, you know, form, content, and style. Well, he bundled up all those papers and mailed them to me. I thought that took a lot of gall. But I have to admit, I couldn't resist reading them. One said, he tended to put his hands in his pockets. Not right today. He was well-dressed with the exception of his necktie. I chose carefully this evening. Another said he didn't move his feet often enough. Well, okay, here you go. But a couple of them also said, Mr. Brinkley, while seemingly well-prepared, failed to offer a firm and helpful conclusion. Well, here's my conclusion today. I want to state right up front, and I may offend some of you, so be ready. I want to state right up front that I believe Israel right now has the worst, most self-destructive government it has ever had. I don't mean to be too subtle about it. I said something recently in a column, and I got volumes of mail telling me I was an anti-Semite, and from all over the United States, a reader in Minneapolis called me a retrobate Jew hater. A more moderate one from a doctor medical doctor here, wrote, "I am saddened by your repeated anti-Israel bias. I fear that it is innate and no amount of discussion over lunch or coffee would change your mind." Well, I wrote back to him because he was at least civil. Once I got a letter from a Dr. Zuckerman in New York when I was based in Israel, and the salutation was, "Dear you filthy piece of scum." And at the bottom, he taped a dollar bill, lift it, and underneath he had scrawled, "This is all a cheap whore like you is worth." You don't believe me? There it is. I keep these things. Maybe one day I'll have a chance to say something nice to him. Well, I wrote back to him, and given the note I said, "I certainly hope you are a pathologist and not someone who actually treats patients." Anyway, responding to the most recent note, also from a doctor, I told him, if I wrote a nasty column about Barack Obama, or about the U.S. military's performance in Afghanistan, or about the Republican House of Representatives, and I've done all of that, would that make me anti-American? What about the lively debate that arose during George W. Bush's administration asking whether Bush was the worst president the United States had ever had? Did those debaters, academics mostly, were they anti-American? No. In my view, Israel and its supporters need to grow up and realize that criticism of behavior does not make you anti-Semitic or anti-Israeli. Isn't facing and dealing with criticism a healthy part of democratic governance? So where does this conclusion about the Israeli government come from? Well, a great deal of experience in the region. This evening I'm going to talk about the Middle East, Israel and the Palestinians particularly, because I spent part of the summer working there, and no other part of the world is more important in the news right now than today than that part of the world. The Palestinians United Nations venture, I'm going to get to that. As you know, I'm a journalist, and even though I left the New York Times a few years ago and took a position at Stanford, I still write, I still travel. That's who I am, that's my passion, I have to. So I write books in this column on foreign affairs, and for that I have to travel every summer. This summer I returned to a very familiar place. I was, as you heard, the newspaper's bureau chief there years ago, and I was sent back many times after that four-year assignment ended. So let's move to Israel and the Palestinians, and I hope I don't offend you. Actually, if you talk about Israel, you're always going to get in trouble no matter what you say. I know that firsthand, and let me give you an example. During my first assignment there, I wrote a long profile for the New York Times Magazine of the Prime Minister then, a fellow named Yitzhak Shamir, and I spent a lot of time with the man and found him to be rather unappealing on a personal level, a humorless little fellow. Well, I decided I was not going to say it just like that in the newspaper. I didn't want to offend him, but I did make passing mention of the fact that he is not tall, and noted that he is not blessed with a great wit or soothing public manner. I pulled back. But the Israeli press loved to pick up what we wrote, and sometimes there were translation problems. And the next morning, the newspaper Chadashot had a 6-column lead headline that said, "New York Times calls Shamir a stupid dwarf." That caused me a few problems, as you might imagine. Israel has, this trip, I actually found some good news, which surprised me. When I was there in July, I went abroad with a big question in my mind, with the Arab world consumed by uprisings, challenging dictators here and there, why were the Palestinians so quiescent? For decades, they had served as a rousing example for the Arab street, fighting two intifadas against Israel, unfortunately complete with hundreds of deaths on both sides and suicide bombings and other terror attacks. I was there for both of them. This time I thought, imagine what could be if Palestinians, like their brothers in Tunisia, Egypt, and Syria, came together in mass peaceful protests day after day, marching in Nablus and Ramallah and Bethlehem, maybe holding candlelight vigils in East Jerusalem. Israel has probably the largest press corps in the world other than Washington and Brussels. And pictures of those demonstrations would be on the front pages of every newspaper worldwide. So I asked Salam Fayyad, who is the Palestinian prime minister, about that. And he told me something surprising. There are calls for demonstrations every day, he said. But these are demonstrations against the government, my government, he said. The minute the Arab Spring began developing, we began getting demands from our own people. And we welcome that. For the first time, Palestinians are making demands of their own leaders instead of blaming all of their woes on Israel. Sure, every Palestinian alive would like to have his own state, and most of them, many of them at least, would like Israel simply to disappear. But that's no longer the simple, single controlling force in their lives, and they have, in fact, picked up a thing or two from their Arab brethren. Khalil Shikaki is a prominent Palestinian pollster, and he told me, for the first time, nonviolence is becoming an acceptable strategy. It's because of Egypt, Tunisia, Syria. People realize there's a lot more to lose from violence. In fact, a few months ago, Palestinian demonstrators demanded that the Palestinian Authority make up with Hamas, the Palestinian terror group, unrepentant killers, who seized control of Gaza in 2007. Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, quickly worked to make that happen, and in May, the two signed a unity agreement. It's foundering now and might never happen, but the Palestinian government earned a great deal of respect from its own people for making the effort. And under the new reality, Shikaki said, if the youths feel Abbas is wavering, they will take to the streets to tell him. As at the same time, as we all know, the Palestinians do have another strategy for the pursuit of statehood, a dangerous one in my view. This week, they will ask the United Nations to grant recognition of a Palestinian state, an independent state. By their way of thinking, negotiations with Israel over the last 40 years have been nothing but disappointing. From my point of view, that is as much a fault of the Palestinians as the Israelis. Both are to blame. In fact, in my opinion, the phrase Middle East peace process is now an oxymoron. A chimera. The first definition of chimera is a female dragon, but the second one is an apparition of something you want but will never see. In fact, the way this has been handled over the years reminds me of the way the Washington Senators baseball team handled itself when I was a boy. Walter Alston, the team's manager, liked to tell reporters, our fans like home runs, and we've acquired a pitching staff to please them. At the end of my first assignment in the Middle East 20 years ago, I gave a number of talks, and every place I went, the audience would ask me, when do you think we'll have peace between Israel and the Palestinians? And I would tell them, not in my lifetime. Well, two decades later, almost to the day, my answer is the same, not in my lifetime, I'm sorry to say. You know, I have noted an amazing thing during the major uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt and Syria and the rest. For decades, Arab leaders had told their people the biggest regional problem was Israel, the Zionists, and their abuse of the Palestinians. That was the dictator's trope. Well, when you watched all those demonstrations in all those states, Israel was not even a factor. It was almost never mentioned. I recall seeing one poster during the Egyptian uprising with Netanyahu with a Nazi swastika over his face. That's the only time I ever saw anything having to do with Israel. These young protesters had utterly rejected the conventional wisdom that they would subordinate their lives to the fight against the Zionists. Perhaps you know why regional leaders like Ahmadinejad and the rest repeatedly refer to Israel as the Zionists. They can't speak the name Israel because in their sclerotic little view, naming the state would confer legitimacy upon it. Sure, I doubt that any of these young Arab protesters cares much for Israel as those rioters who attacked the Israeli embassy in Cairo last week vividly demonstrated. But is the Israel problem a major factor in their lives? I don't think so. They want dignity, prosperity, and freedom, more or less in that order. That is their priority now. Israel? So what? Think about that. Watch the demonstrations in Syria right now. Do you hear any of them talking about Israel? I find that pretty amazing. So, I have seen this as an extraordinary opportunity for Israel to find accommodation with new, hopefully democratic states, hopefully dominated by a generation of people who may not have rabid anti-Israel animus coursing through their blood. Take this opportunity, show some flexibility, and show some reason. Well, unfortunately, quite the opposite has occurred. Let me give you just one example. You may have seen that Israelis staged their own Arab Spring demonstrations over the summer and even now. Hundreds of thousands of them have been staging massive demonstrations nationwide over high prices, particularly the price and scarcity of housing. That, too, was an extraordinary development. Israelis telling their leaders, we are no longer willing to subordinate our lives entirely to security. Well, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with the demonstrators. He held emergency cabinet meetings. He came up with a plan. Israel would build thousands of new settlement homes in Arab East Jerusalem. Some plan, huh? To be fair, many people in Israel do not consider these new homes to be settlements. Israel annexed East Jerusalem in 1967, although not one nation in the world recognizes that. Palestinians were furious, of course, and if Israel was trying to show a new face to the Arab world and the rest of the world, it was of a state that was even more hardline. Already Tunisia, the first Arab nation to lose its head of state in an uprising, has written into its new draft constitution an outright prohibition of normalizing relations with the state of Israel. And look what happened last week. Anti-Israel riots in Egypt. Turkey expelled the Israeli ambassador. Israel's in trouble. Now, it's quite possible that Tunisia would have written that prohibition into its constitution no matter what Israel did, even if it had made a last-minute, quick, and durable peace with the Palestinians. We can say the same thing about the riots in Egypt and the new hardline in Turkey, but we'll never know, will we? I still see this as a magnificent opportunity, squandered, to win new recognition or to show the Arab states for what they really are, one or the other. As I mentioned, and as you certainly already know, the Palestinians have a plan to ask the UN to recognize them. They're on the way to New York right now. Actually, I'm heading to New York myself tomorrow to cover this. Well, there are two ways to go, as you can go through the Security Council and ask for recognition as a state, as South Sudan did earlier this year, then to the General Assembly, and then you become a UN member state. A few days ago, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, announced that was exactly his plan. Well, the United States has made it clear it will veto any such Security Council request. Perhaps you read my column on that this week, but I see this, the veto, as a dangerous mistake. Even as Israel's traditional patron state, the United States has been making tenuous gains in the Arab world by participating in NATO's action in Libya and providing groups in Egypt, Yemen, and elsewhere with help. With a veto, all of that would likely be undone. In fact, Saudi Arabia, another of Washington's traditional allies in the region, is warning that will curtail relations with Washington and pursue policies anathema to the United States if the veto goes through. This was Turki Al-Faisal, a member of the Saudi royal family and a former ambassador to Washington. He wrote this in the New York Times. And I've met him and interviewed him several times in Saudi Arabia and in Washington, where he was ambassador for a while. And I found him to be a calm, reasonable man, and I don't see this as posturing. As I wrote, then, when this comes up in the Security Council, if I were president, I would at least abstain. Obama will do significant damage by issuing that veto. After the veto, if it happens, the Palestinians say they're going to try an alternative, simply ask the General Assembly of a collection of all the world's 193 nations to vote on whether to recognize Palestine as a state. No one doubts that the Palestinians would win that vote. Ron Dermer, a senior advisor to Prime Minister Netanyahu, told me, quote, "We have no chance of winning. We have maybe 30 or 40 countries on our side." He was shaking his head. But that victory in the Security Council would be symbolic only. It would carry no weight of law. A PR victory for the Palestinians, a little more, embarrassing for Israel, but also dangerous for the Palestinians. That Palestinian pollster, Khalil Shikaki, found in a recent survey that the public supports the September process, he said, but the minute the leadership returns from New York, Palestinian youths expect them to begin exercising absolute sovereignty. Prime Minister Fayyad threw up his hands at that and declaimed, "I can't deliver. That's not my thinking about September at all," he told me. Assert absolute sovereignty unilaterally? The truth is, he added, the day after the vote will in no way be different, the same as the day before. The question arises then, why would the U.S. veto an actual statehood resolution in the Security Council? It has been the goal of every American president since Lyndon Johnson to give the Palestinians a state based loosely on the ceasefire lines of the 1967 war. In fact, in 1967, Secretary of State Dean Rusk stated that in future negotiations, quote, "The Israeli border along the West Bank could be rationalized. Certain anomalies could easily be straightened out with some exchanges of territory, making a more sensible border for all parties." At that time, Israel conditionally agreed. And that is exactly what the proposal President Obama made last summer, the one that Netanyahu savaged before the United States Congress. Well, ever since, every attempt at negotiated settlement has failed. So why not try a different route? I'll tell you, because of the government's, every administration's slavish loyalty to even the most right-wing government in Israel, no matter what. It's all electoral politics. Not just politically influential Jews, but millions of evangelical Christians, tens of millions of them, nationwide, who are also stolid supporters of the Israeli right, no matter what, principally for religious reasons. So where does this lead us? The Palestinians will win their support in the General Assembly. From around the world, leaders had urged Netanyahu to use the summer to begin peace talks, to show flexibility so some states might pull back from supporting the Palestinians. Well, as you know, he did the opposite. So that vote will further marginalize Israel, the last thing it needs right now, just after the rebukes from Egypt and Turkey and even from Jordan last week, where there were small demonstrations. American opposition to the Security Council resolution will harden hatred of the U.S. and the Arab world. With a veto, more than likely, we alone will be the ones blocking. We, the United States alone, will be the ones blocking statehood for the Palestinians. The other UN Security Council members with veto power all will vote for the Palestinians. But it will also put the Palestinian leadership in a serious bind. They will win the General Assembly vote, get the headlines around the world. As their Prime Minister put it, though, the next day will be no different from the day before. I expect to see some unrest, perhaps even a third intifada. I certainly hope not. Remember what Shikaki the pollster said about anticipation among Palestinian youths. Full sovereignty as soon as they return from New York. So I hope as you read the news in the coming days, you'll think about some of the things we've said here tonight. A couple of weeks ago, the Palestinian leadership said their people are in fact going to hold peaceful protests around the time of the UN vote, right now, and they have begun. When I asked Prime Minister Fayyad in July why they were not protesting for statehood, then it seemed a foreign concept to him, holding peaceful demonstrations. Many Israelis also looked perplexed when I brought up this idea. Naor Gion, Deputy Director General in the Foreign Ministry, told me, I can't see it staying peaceful for long. People want to defend themselves, protect their property. Israelis are not equipped to deal with nonviolence. People realize it would be a march to slaughter. And Fayyad agreed, saying, I don't want to see us slide back and reach a flashpoint where kids are killed. We should hope this does not come about. The small demonstrations so far, I think they're going to pick up this week, have in fact been peaceful. No one has been hurt and no one has been killed. Actually, though, you might be surprised to learn how often death plays a role in seemingly peaceful political events. Let me give you an example from a world away in distance and time, a short story about Lyndon Johnson, a story he told my father once, and then he told me about Johnson's get-out-the-vote strategy for his House of Representatives campaigns in Texas. He sent men into graveyards to get names of voters off of tombstones. One time, one of the registrars was having a hard time reading the name on one really old gravestone. Lyndon, this fellow said, I can't read this one. It's faded and all colored with moths. I think we're going to have to skip him. But Johnson shouted back at him, what do you mean skip him? He's got as much right to vote as anybody here. Thank you.
Our thanks to Joel Brinkley, Stanford Professor of Journalism, syndicated columnist, and former Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the New York Times. I'm John Diaz, editorial page editor for the San Francisco Chronicle, and I'm going to be moderating tonight's audience question period. A reminder for our radio audience, you are listening to a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's topic, Israel in the Arab Spring. And thank you to the audience. We do have a number of very good questions. Let's start with this one, Joel. How can Israel reasonably be expected to deal with two Palestinian entities? They can't seem to agree on anything.
I don't think they can, and I don't think they should, and I don't think they have to. I would hope, and I'm sure the way Mahmoud Abbas is talking now, he plans to leave Gaza out of this. Gaza, I've met the leaders of Hamas more than once over many years, and they are unrepentant killers. They will not compromise on anything. They will never give up. They see it as a generational battle. They will never give up their hope to just eradicate the state of Israel and everyone who lives there. So I think this should proceed, leaving Gaza out of it, and I think that is Abbas's plan.
Several questions, Joel, about the changing relationship between Turkey and Israel recently. Please comment.
What's the question exactly?
It was basically how should Israel respond to Turkey in light of the Arab Spring?
You know, when the United Nations earlier this month came up with its own report on the flotilla tragedy a year ago last summer, it said that Israel had every right to maintain a blockade of Gaza, but it overreacted when its soldiers boarded the boat and killed a number of people. Turkey demanded an apology. So the Israeli cabinet formulated a response to say something about we're sorry about the way the boarding of the ship turned out, you know, without admitting that there was an error, they were sorry that it ended up killing people. Well, the foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who is as right as anybody in the government, refused to do it, refused to issue that statement. And Netanyahu folded, and so they didn't do anything. And that is the story of how that particular event occurred when Israel's ambassador was kicked out of Istanbul.
Joel, you mentioned that to a certain degree the United States is going to be isolated out there defending Israel in terms of the General Assembly vote and then when it goes to the Security Council. How much of this support for the Palestinian state among other countries is genuinely heartfelt, and how much of it is just an easy vote for them because they know the United States is going to do the tough call?
Most of Europe, most of Asia looks at Israel, and the only thing people see is the Palestinian problem. That's not fair, but it's true. I was in this trip to Israel, I was also with some Europeans, and at the end we talked to a number of people, and at the end we had a summation of what we thought, and the Europeans, they were vicious in their dislike of Israel primarily over the Palestinian issue. So I think the leaders of these countries are voting what their people want when they vote in favor of the Palestinian state and from most of the world.
What do you see in terms of the Obama administration and the United States? Is the president representing the feelings of the American people?
I don't know that the American people, if you looked at broadly, have strong opinions on this. There are extremely politically influential groups, as we discussed earlier, that do have strong opinions on that, and that is who the Congress and the White House caters to, no matter who is sitting in those chairs.
Here's a question that quotes your August 14th column. And it is in quote marks. First of all, see if it matches your recollection. Quote, I do not favor anything more than perhaps a small token Palestinian return to their ancestors' home places in Israel. Others, if they want, can move to the West Bank. Why is that your preference?
Versus what? I think to make a peace agreement, if Israel wanted to make a peace agreement, the right of return is as important to the Palestinians as settlements are to the right in Israel. And why not give them, you know, a few hundred or a thousand spaces in Israel? That's not going to change the demography of the state at all. A token agreement. And the truth is, though, this pollster I talked to, Shikaki, a couple of years ago did a survey of Palestinian refugees, as they still call themselves 40 years later, refugees, in most of the surrounding states. He did a survey of all of them, and about 6% said they wanted to go back anyway. They've made lives elsewhere. A lot of it is still living in refugee camps. The Palestinians want to continue making a statement that they're not going to settle in until they move back to their homes. That's a pretty rabid point of view. But the truth is that most of them don't want to come back anyway.
Joel, what would you propose that Israel would have to give up in order to get a peace agreement with the Palestinians? Jerusalem? Removal of Jews from West Bank. What do you think is a practical solution to all this?
Israel, you know, the West Bank has a shape that's sort of like this, and then up to Jerusalem. And in these lower areas, which are close to the sea, are settlements that are not ideological. The bulk of the people in settlements are in these big blocks, Ma'ale Adumim, and I think the other one is Ariel. And these are bedroom communities for people who work in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, and they're not ideological. Now, they would leave, but I think what would have to happen as Dean Rusk and Barack Obama suggested in 40 years apart, there'll have to be some territorial trades. This territory that is right in where the West Bank juts right into the center of Israel, the Palestinians probably would have to give up. And they'd get other territory, perhaps at the south and north, in exchange. Israel would have to empty its settlements, most of them. It did that in Gaza. It did that in Sinai. It can be done. And I think if you go to Jerusalem, East Jerusalem is huge, quite large. And to give part of that, not the part next to the old city, to give part of that to the Palestinians as their capital is not really that great a sacrifice. Another issue that Israel insists on is to have a military force along the border with the Jordan River. I don't know. That may be the toughest one. If I were forming a new state, I wouldn't want my state hemmed in by troops on both sides.
When you speak of giving up those settlements as being not that much of a sacrifice, are you talking about monetarily or strategically?
I'm talking about politically. It's going to be, they're going to scream and they're going to yell, the settlers. The settlers in Sinai screamed and yelled. The settlers in Gaza screamed and yelled. Politically, this will be harder because there are far more of them. There are 350,000 of them. And it's also going to be expensive. The only way to get them out is to pay them off and provide them new homes. I think I wrote a column a few weeks ago where I estimated the cost to be more than $50 billion. So it's going to be expensive and it's going to be politically difficult, but it's been done before and it can be done again.
Reminder to our radio audience that you are listening to a program with the Commonwealth Club of California with Joel Brinkley. I'm John Diaz, the editorial page editor for the Chronicle, and tonight Joel is talking about the topic Israel in the Arab Spring. Let's go to another audience question. Assuming a scenario where the Palestinian resolution were to pass, wouldn't that mean that UN peacekeepers would be sent in to manage the situation? And does anyone really expect the UN and the primary world powers to do this?
I'm assuming you mean if it does pass the Security Council and it is actually a legal state. The UN is already there. There's the United Nations Relief Works Agency and other UN forces in the West Bank right now, and I suspect the UN would not put itself in the position of enforcing this. Israel is a nation of the world, and it knows it would have to respect a UN resolution, but it would. The truth is that if the West Bank were suddenly a state, and to be honest, I don't think this is going to happen, but if it were suddenly a state, it's a state with Israeli troops threaded throughout it, and 350,000 Israelis living in it, that is what will push Israel to the negotiating table. And you, at that table, we don't have any preconditions. So that's what will happen, and the entire world will be watching very closely. As I said, Israel has one of the largest press corps in the world, foreign press corps. So I don't think the UN will need or want to go in and try to enforce this.
Joel, you mentioned that this was one of the most, I forget your exact words, but basically counterproductive Israeli leadership that's been in some time. But hasn't the whole dynamic changed politically in Israel in, say, the last decade, where the idea of a two-state solution now is considered a given, whereas that was not the case not all that long ago?
That's exactly right. The problem is that there's been another change in the population in Israel. It has gone farther right, just as our Congress has gone farther right for different reasons. Part of it was Hamas firing thousands of rockets into Israel and the view that if you give up territory, then you're going to get rockets from both sides. Now, that's a legitimate concern. But I don't think the people on the West Bank are inclined to do that. That's my reading from having been there many times. So yes, most of people in Israel realize that if there is a peace solution, it has to be a two-state solution. But at the same time, the right is in control of the government.
Number of questions related to Arab Spring and the context that this is happening. What are your thoughts, Joel, an audience member asked about democracy in Arab societies? Is that really a plausible expectation?
I don't want to say that Arabs are incapable of being democratic. Lebanon's a relatively democratic country, and I don't think there's any place that cannot make a transition to democracy if so motivated and equipped. But there are several problems. One, there's an axiom that applies to this, and that is that democracy is not going to work in any country. A transition is not going to work unless the leadership, the remaining leadership and oligarchy of the country wants it. Otherwise, they will fight to retain their positions and perquisites and not be thrust out of influence and money because of democracy. The other thing is, and this is a big problem, I once wrote a story years ago, this was 2004, about the Bush administration spending $51 million to stage anti-government, to train Ukrainians to stage anti-government uprisings. What they were after was exactly what we saw in the Arab Spring. So it worked. The Soviet-backed leader of the country was forced out, and a democratic leader was put in his place. The problem was that he took over the country, and there were great expectations for big changes. They wanted dignity, prosperity, freedom, just like the people in Egypt. But the country had no civil society, no institutions of social welfare, no free press, none of the things you need for a democracy. And it failed. And guess who is the leader of Ukraine right now? That Soviet-backed fellow who was kicked out during those demonstrations. Well, you look at Libya and Egypt and Syria and certainly Yemen. How many civil society organizations do you see in those countries? How many free newspapers and TV shows? None. I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I don't see any of the – I believe that if a democratic leader is elected in Egypt, huge demands are going to fall upon him immediately, and he's not going to have the wherewithal to carry them out. That's what I fear.
Question from the audience about the late U.S. Senator Charles Percy, who died in the past few days. Senator Percy fervently advocated balance in Palestinian-Israeli affairs, which was a factor in his defeat in 1984. What do you think that sort of message sends to other members of the Senate or U.S. House of Representatives who may want a more balanced view?
Well, that message and another one sends a very strong message. I don't know if you may recall this, but George H.W. Bush, the first, was really tough on Israel. I was based in Israel at that time, and he demanded that they stop settlements if he was to fulfill Israel's request from Washington for loan guarantees to build housing for immigrating Russian Jews, tens of thousands of them. And Bush said, I'm not going to do it unless you stop settlements. And I talked to Yitzhak Shamir about that. He was the prime minister then. And he said, oh, I'm not worried about it. They'll change their mind. Well, when he ran for reelection, Bush, when he ran the first time, he won Florida by a huge majority. When he ran the second time, he lost Florida. That is why his son, when he came, that was a huge issue. Remember how important Florida is in electoral politics. That's why his son, George W. Bush, was Israel's best friend from the first day of office to the last. And that is why whenever Israel is in trouble, the United States Senate pulls up a resolution in support of Israel and approves it 99-1 every single time.
Who is the one, Joel?
probably someone from Nevada.
A number of questions speaking of the context of the Middle East, and that is a number of questions about what a Palestinian state would pretend for Iran. First of all, is it likely that that would further inflame the situation to have an ally in with a new Palestinian state? And can we live with a fully nuclear Iran?
Well, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad just last week or 2 weeks ago said, if we can get a Palestinian state, there will be no room for Israel. That's his favorite topic. I just wonder what he's going to have to say if the Palestinian state comes about and he's got nothing to complain about anymore. I guess he'll think of something. A nuclear Iran is a scary prospect, not because I believe they're going to fire weapons at anyone, but because they are famous proliferators. Hezbollah and Hamas and other terrorist groups are at home in Iran, and I would hate to have a country that is a famous friend of terrorist groups get a hold of a nuclear weapon and then give it to Al-Qaeda or somebody else. And those groups would have no compunction in using them.
Along those lines, Joel Brinkley, what do you say to those who claim Israel cannot budge on its position because Hamas will not be content until Israel is destroyed?
I think it can budge on its position in the West Bank because the West Bank has cut itself off from Hamas in most ways. And I was very impressed by what I saw in the West Bank this recent trip. Ramallah, the capital, has a strong and useful police force. The schools have been improved. There's a lot of business. Economic growth averages about 8% in recent years. I think they can make a go of it because they will have a lot of friends in the world. They will have a lot of trade. And they will be able to say, forget about Gaza. I'm pretty sure that's what they're doing now, and that's what I hope they do in the unlikely event that this succeeds. And I don't know of a solution for Gaza, short of a uprising there that throws Hamas out of power, but I haven't seen any sign of that.
Question, what can you tell us about AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, and its influence in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I can tell you to begin with that when I was covering foreign affairs for the Times in 2004 to 2006 and wrote about Israel frequently, I never called AIPAC, not once. I think they are a maligned force for Israel. Their point of view is exactly the thing I was talking about earlier, that we as Jews must support Israel no matter what it does, no matter what it says, no matter what the government is up to. And I think that is dangerous for Israel and its supporters, and so I'm not a fan.
Here's an interesting question or suggestion from a reader. What do you think about two states with identical borders forming a condominium? Would that be a win-win situation? Palestinians could return. Israel could be 100% Jewish. An internal and external security would be managed by integrated police and armed forces. How would you like to broker that deal, Joel Brinkley?
That would be just great, and it also totally, completely impossible.
Okay, question from the audience of, can you give us any insights on Israel targeting execution of Hamas leaders?
Israel has already killed half a dozen Hamas leaders. I interviewed a bunch of them in 2002, and half of the ones I spoke to then are dead because they were the subject of targeted killings. Now, whether they will continue doing that, I don't know. I suspect that there's one, Mahmoud, forgotten his name. I can get him on the phone now and then, but I don't know exactly where he is, and I suspect the Israelis don't know exactly where he is either. After the leader of Hamas and several of the major figures in Hamas were killed in the 2000s, I suspect the current leaders of Hamas are not making themselves publicly known very often.
Joel, one of the reasons that you suggested that the United States abstain is that this UN vote will really have no practical matter, that the Palestinian territories would be the same the day before as the day after. So why should President Obama just not go ahead and vote yes?
Well, there's a distinction here. If the Palestinians go to the Security Council, which they're planning to do in the next couple of days, and the Security Council votes to approve their request for statehood, then they go to the General Assembly, and the General Assembly essentially ratifies that with a two-thirds vote. Well, if the U.S. vetoes the Security Council vote, then they go to the General Assembly, and it's simply a statement and carries no rule of law. But if the Security Council approves it and then the General Assembly approves it, then they are actually a UN member state at that point with all the rights and privileges that come with that.
We have a question from the audience about the role of media in coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian situation. Joel, you mentioned basically how the political world is very much influenced by Israel. What about the mainstream media?
Well, I would suggest, speaking for myself, I don't think I'm influenced by Israel. I mean, just what I just said and what I wrote. But when I was based there as recently as 2006 for a month, and then this summer, I don't. American reporters don't take sides. They don't attach themselves to one side or the other. The British press is completely different. They do. But I don't really have any relationship with Israel. I don't have any relationship with the Palestinians. I'm willing to criticize or praise either one of them, and I think that's how most of my colleagues view it. For a long time, there was the New York Times forbade Jews from taking the job in Israel. And that changed with Tom Friedman because he had been reporting in Lebanon before that and during the Israeli invasion. And this is a long time ago, and I'm embarrassed to say it, but at that time the newspaper realized that, yes, you can cover an Israeli thing, Israeli action without bias, even if you're Jewish. Well, it's embarrassing even to admit that people thought that, but that was 30 years ago. And since then, actually most of the people who have gone there after me were Jewish, and they've done a good job.
Reminder to our radio audience, you are listening to Joel Brinkley of Stanford University at the Commonwealth Club of California, talking tonight on Israel and the Arab Spring. And I'm John Diaz, the moderator, and let's go to another audience question. And that is, if Israel were to withdraw to the 67 borders and the suicide bombers and missiles kept coming from Gaza and southern Lebanon, what would you suggest Israel should do then?
As long as they're not coming from the West Bank, I don't think there's the two are related. If Hezbollah and Hamas are united in the view that Israel has no right to be there, that's a problem that is not going to go away with giving the Palestinians a state. Hezbollah is not a Palestinian organization. It's a Shiite organization. I would regard these as separate issues. And if Hamas and Hezbollah were firing rockets and the West Bank was peaceful, I think the world would side with Israel on that.
Israel is a small country, the audience member observes. Why divide it up and have the chance that Hamas will take it over? With 2 billion Arabs worldwide, if they wanted peace, they would have had peace years ago. Your thoughts?
My thoughts are that Arab world has used the Palestinians as the excuse for outright opposition to Israel all these years. Settle the Palestinian issue, and then you will either remove the mask or you'll find that they are more amenable to acceptance, one or the other. But as long as you give all these people the excuse of, as they put it, abusing the Palestinians, nothing's going to change. So remove the excuse. And the truth is that if the West Bank were turned into a Palestinian state and it became militant and started firing missiles at Israel, Israel will go right back in, just as it is right now. I hope that didn't happen, but it would not be that hard to do.
Joel, you mentioned during your speech that 20 years ago, you concluded that peace was not going to happen within your lifetime, an opinion that you still hold today, which raises the question, a peace process, virtually every president for the last 20 or 30 years has made the peace process part of his foreign policy platform. Is it an exercise in futility?
It has been thus far. I've always been of the view that a president can't really get serious about trying to enter the Middle East debate until his second term, until he doesn't have to worry about re-election. And a few presidents like Clinton tried that. It still didn't work. I am of the view that we've got to stop thinking about the grand solution, because it's just not going to happen, and that we ought to try to find a way to make these two people live together comfortably, even if they don't have their own independent state, because I just don't think it's going to happen.
Can that be done with the disjointed borders, the road situation, the settlements? Do you really think that's plausible?
Well, it's fairly peaceful right now. And as I said, the Palestinians are making lives for themselves even under this situation. I don't think this should have to be all they get. But there are all sorts of people around the world, the Kurds, you can find groups all over the world that want states and don't get them, but still find a way to create lives for themselves. I just don't think the politics of this are such that you're going to get a grand solution of this anytime soon. I hope I'm wrong, but I haven't been thus far over the last two decades.
Audience member wants to know what you see happening in the near term, in other words, in the next few months, after Palestine is vetoed by the UN and the Security Council, by the United States in the Security Council, but okayed in the General Assembly. What do you think that portends for the other Middle East countries, for Israel, for the United States?
I think it gives the Arab countries exactly the excuse they need for anti-Americanism and more anti-Israel activities. With that symbolic vote, it will give the Palestinians the right to go to the International Criminal Court and bring cases against Israel for settlements or whatever they choose, which means that Israel will get an even more of a black eye, and it's going to be even more untenable for Washington to be uncritically siding with them. But that's the politics of America, and I don't see it changing.
What do you think it means in terms of, certainly the United States has been very active in the Arab world in light of the Arab Spring? Is it going to undermine our ability to have influence in these fledgling democracies?
I absolutely do think it will hurt our ability to have influence. I don't think we have much influence even now. These fledgling democracies, if they become that, there are going to be elections in Tunisia and Egypt this year. Later this year, I don't think the United States should go in directly, except perhaps to provide aid. The Arab League, the United Nations, the EU, those are the ones you should go in, because we just have such a bad reputation in that part of the world already. It's getting a little better. but we're not the ones, because of our longstanding support of Israel, to have to go in there and try to be the arbiters for these fledgling states.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point where we have time for just one more question, and that was about the changing demographics in Israel. Joel, how do you see that changing the domestic political situation in terms of pushing for a solution?
The changing demographics, meaning age or the...
Increasing Arab population in Israel, I'm presuming.
Well, there's this line that the left of Israel in the United States likes to use, and that is that pretty soon, including the West Bank, there will be more Palestinians in all these territories than there are Jews. Well, I don't know why that makes any difference, because they're in the West Bank, and that's not part of Israel. They don't register to vote. They don't have any say in what goes on in Israel. And the Israeli Arab population, I don't remember the figures, but it's relatively small and does not threaten to become larger than the Jewish population in any time in the next century. So I don't see that as a significant problem.
Thank you, Joel. Please join me in thanking Joel Brinkley for his comments here tonight. I would also like to thank our audience, both here as well as those listening to the broadcast recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 108 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.